This is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures.
Hello, everyone. We are here live from location on retreat at Rawson. Hello, Catherine Collette.
Hello, Kate Mildenhall. It's kind of a funny thing to say live, though, isn't it?
It is, because we are together. Yeah, We've been together for a couple of days. We are not alone. We are joined by our friend and friend of the pod, Anna Downs. You might have heard Anna on the pod before, dear listeners. If you don't know her, Anna Downs is the internationally best-selling author of The Safe Place and The Shadow House, and she has a brand new thriller, which we haven't at all been talking about, Red River Road, which is coming out with a firm in 2024. Welcome to the podcast, Anna Downs.
Hello. This is very nice and exciting. Thank you for having me today.
We are, this is an audio form. Can you please, Anna, use your best skills in just giving our listeners a sense of where we are right now?
Oh, goodness. Okay. We are in a beautiful wooden miner's cottage in, where are we? Rawson, Victoria.
We are Rawson.
Which is not far from Walhalla,
mm-hmm.
where we visited today. We're, how far out of Melbourne are we? Like two hours,
yeah,
out of Melbourne. It feels like out the back windows, it feels like we're in the middle of nowhere. It feels very alpine. It feels like we're really high in the mountains.
It does.
There's when we drive out, there's not really very much around. Tiny little houses. There's a very pleasant looking gentleman who mows his lawn just a few houses over with a ride on mower, even though his lawn is about 4 square meters.
And the general store is not what we thought.
No.
Actually, only you've been there though, Catherine.
Was it even open?
It was open. It is the worst general store. There was a review online that said something to the effect of, it could have been a gem and yet it doesn't have the merest sparkle or something to that effect. It is the most bizarre collection of goods that are on sale in addition to fried foods.
All of which seem thoroughly unnecessary as well.
Of course, we don't need the general store because we're well and truly packed, because we are on a retreat. Now, working out when to go on a retreat is tough. We all of us have primary school age children who we have been talking to at home. We have scheduling commitments that come along with them and other things. I booked this place way back in May or June, partly because I knew I wanted to visit here, because it's inspo for the new book, and also because I knew if I didn't book it in before the end of the year and after the tour, I would feel so guilty about leaving my family at this point in time because I've been away so much that I wouldn't get it done. So where I want us to start is to, if you could both, Anna and Catherine, give us the context of where you are in your general book commitments at the moment and what it is that you are working on for this 5-day retreat.
I'll go first. Well, in a fortuitous sort of timing event, I got my copy edit the Friday before we came here. So I have had that land. I have 3 weeks to turn that around.
Hang on. So can I interrupt there for a second? Because the very strangest thing you did was you got your copy edit and did not look at it. And Anna and I both had to say, Catherine, what do you mean you haven't looked at it yet?
I know. Well, it wasn't part of the plan. So the plan was to work on this middle grade book that is due in February. I hoped to write 10,000 words. That's absolutely not going to happen. But I still stuck with the plan for the first 2 days. Then I decided I would open the copy edit and have realized there is probably more involved than I had envisaged. But the cool thing that we have been doing that I'm we're going to talk a little bit about is workshopping. So I have a novel, an adult novel, that I have 50,000 terrible, terrible words of. And so we're kind of workshopping the early stages of the concept, but we'll talk more about that. So the plan that I thought that I had is very different to what I'll end up doing.
That's the perfect way to do a retreat. Anna, what's happening in your professional life right now? Where are you and what was your goal for this retreat?
So I've just finished several rather significant structural edits and I've handed that back. It's now gone to copy edit and I'm waiting to get that back. And I, when you first floated the idea of this retreat, I thought that was going to match up. And I thought I would be here doing the copy edit, but it just hasn't worked out quite like that. I think it's going to be another week or so till I get the copy edit back. So what I'm doing is immersing myself in a brand new idea for book four, which is such a treat because I've actually never done a writing retreat when I haven't been on a deadline. So usually for me, writing retreats are, you know, I'll reach out to some friends or, you know, friends will reach out to me and most of the time I'll be like, yes, I desperately need time to get away and work, but it's almost always been towards a deadline. So what that looks like is, you know, you get to wherever you're going and I shut myself in a room with some noise cancelling headphones and some coffee and I just go and go and go. And but that's not been the case here. And it's been an absolute kind of revelation to have had time to read and research. What I've been trying to do specifically, though, because as I'm sure many people can relate to, you can get so involved and kind of not bogged down exactly because it's more joyful than that, but you know, the researching and the wallowing and the play of it, the kind of the ideation stage where you're trying really hard to find the idea and you're following rabbit holes and you know, the options are endless and the energy is so fun. And you know, at the same time, you're also kind of putting off actually, you know, setting anything down and you know, laying the words down, doing the hard part, basically. So I have been wanting to enjoy that, but also not get lost in it and spend my time wisely by being as specific as I can about what exactly I need in order to reach this retreat's goal, which is to have a full outline, by which I mean a synopsis with beginning, middle, end, and all your plot points and all that, but not so rigid that I feel necessarily married to anything, but enough that I have a framework that when I, you know, have done the copy edit of Red River Road, I can start writing.
And this is really important. So Catherine and I have, we have retreated together many times before. We have often had deadlines or things that we were working on. We've not retreated with you, either of us before, no. Anna. You have brought to the table this new idea of workshopping almost like a writer's room. I too am in the start of a brand new concept for a novel. Can you just give us a bit of a sense of what you brought to the table in the idea of workshopping at this early phase and what that looks like and where it comes from?
So I think it's come from the fact that by some twist of fate, we all have brand new ideas in very, very early stages, which is unusual. Usually when you go away on a writing retreat, everybody's at different stages of their careers, you know, but also different stages of their works in progress. And I thought, I've been thinking for a while, I have some friends that are screenwriters, and when we talk about the process of screenwriting and the different ways in which stories are built and put together when there are multiple minds in the room, that has been very appealing to me. I think because, you know, my storytelling training is in acting, but, it's in devising theatre and being in a rehearsal room where there are lots and lots and lots of different skill sets in the room. There's lots of different people. There's lots of voices. There's lots of minds. And there's this kind of one idea or many, many ideas that are being filtered through this sort of this group of people and the dynamic. And it is just, it's fast, it's fun, it's efficient, it's energetic. You kind of, as a group of actors, you can try something in a certain way and go, well, how about, why don't we, okay, let's pretend we're in a circus, all right? And we've got to deliver all our lines, but the show's going to go on any minute. So, how does that change it? And then you'll go, well, that felt a little bit too frantic. So how about now we change it? So how about we all imagine that we're waiting at a bus stop and we're all going to deliver our lines in a different way. How does that change it? How does it feel? And I thought, God, wouldn't that be brilliant if you could do that with one of your early ideas? And so I've been kind of wanting to do this for ages. So when we rocked up and I'm like, oh my God, everybody has an early stage idea. Why don't we set aside, an hour or two in the afternoon where we workshop that idea? There's lots and lots of different ways to do that. I mean, certainly with me, like we just did today, I kind of say to you guys, this is what I'm not sure about. I kind of outline the whole idea for the book. Spoilers and all, and I say, this is what I'm not sure about. I don't know why this person would want to go this here. And that thinking process alone in a room by yourself could take weeks. Weeks of walking and trying things, and maybe you might write a couple of scenes and you're like, no, it doesn't quite work because I don't really buy that they want to do it for that reason. And if you're workshopping, you can burn through a whole bunch of different options together. And it's just the energy is there, the want to do it, the excitement. It doesn't feel too hard. It doesn't feel like your brain's about to explode. It's joyful. It's like chat. It's play. So I thought that would be a really good idea.
So, Catherine, from your perspective, because we haven't done this before, what did it feel like? We've done it for you now. Like, what's your perspective on the other side?
It's so good. Like, I really repeat what you say about that. You have a particular question. So I think all of us on the ideas that we're working at, some slightly more progressed, but might have a series of images or I really want it to be about this. And just that act of being able to go, well, how would that work? Why would they do that with other people is incredible.
And it's like you catch the excitement of everyone else's process at the same time.
Yeah. It's also just like, if you have a thematic thing that you are looking at, what connections other people make that your brain just might never have made is fantastic.
I also think that, like, the one writer's room that I have been in, there was a very much a sense that, at least one person in the room took on the responsibility of anchoring the ideas to the story. So, maybe a couple of minds would go off and they'd be going, oh my God, it'd be so good if we could have this scene in X setting and maybe this happens and then we can really bring in the themes about this because actually all I want to do is kind of tell a story that's set in a florist. I just want it because I really like flowers and I want to talk about flowers. And there's another mind in the room that's kind of going, yeah, but what's the story point? You might want to be talking about flowers and go down the flower rabbit hole or whatever. It's a really terrible example. But, what's the plot point? What's the story point? Bring it back. And so that's kind of what we can do for each other in that scenario where, you're saying, I just have this image and I want it to be about this. And it's like, well, an idea isn't, let's take my book, The Shadow House. An idea isn't, I want to write about an eco village. An idea is, what if X happened at an eco village? So when you've got three people on the job and everybody's kind of, oh, you could do this. Oh my God, what if it's this? It's just so much more. Generative. Yeah, generative, exactly.
It's like a form of, I think about you and your improvisation work, Catherine. And it's kind of, it's like that permission giving. It's like a form of improvisation.
I think it's really exciting too. And even getting a really intimate sense of other people's projects and suggesting a dozen things, and some land and some don't.
Mm.
It just is a super, super fun process. The other like super basic thing is what people Google.
Yes.
Like you saying Google alert, put up a hashtag this particular thing on Instagram and you'll be able to follow it. But like easy thing to do, but I would never have thought of it.
No. And also this is the delight of being in the same space. So two key things that I've taken from you two in these couple of days that we've had together. Catherine, you talked about how in your spreadsheets for planning a new work, one of the things you do is look at the phrase that in this scene, whatever this scene is, we learn that. And then the character does this thing. And just that phrase, we learn that, which is so important for both reader and author, is a thing that I've just written straight into my document. It's almost like changed my process overnight. The thing that you gave me, Anna, which you have told me before but have reiterated this couple of days, is the idea of an author believing in their red herrings, that they have to, you have to sell them to a reader, you have to fully be invested in that as being the truth. And as someone who's coming to a different form this time around or a different genre, that is incredibly important and insightful.
Well, I think it's certainly most applicable to genre fiction, you know, where you're thinking very much along the lines of what happens. I think if you're writing mystery, crime, suspense, thriller stuff, it's really helpful to frame your story or kind of hang your story on these kind of pegs of red herrings. You know, what do you want your reader to think at first? And then how might you nudge them in this direction? And then how might you nudge them in a different direction? So what we've been doing is, you know, with your idea, Kate, you say, well, this is the end point, and this is what happens to this particular person. And so then we've workshopped all the different things that could possibly have resulted in that. And then, so then you have a whole list of, I'm going to use, you know, an example of a body in a creek. If you've got a body in a creek at the end of a book, what are all the possible reasons that that body could be found, you know, made its way into a creek? So you've got a list of, you know, he fell, he was pushed, he was, you know, trying to rescue someone. He was trying to find a particular thing that might be buried at the, I don't know, whatever. He was kayaking and got stuck. All of those things you then, or you might go in to say, well, he's actually, you know, he was killed by a debt collector. He was murdered by his ex-wife, or, you know, so then you kind of imbue some of your characters with those red herrings in terms of you set them up to be those things. And that informs your story, informs your characters. And as an author, as you said, if you can pick certainly one, maybe two, maybe three, that you can kind of write your story as if they are the thing, you're going to much more effectively not fool your reader, but you know, the point is that it's a puzzle worth solving, and everything feels important and urgent and true and authentic. So, you know, you kind of have to really believe in those things in order to make them effective, I think.
I think what's been really enjoyable about the workshop process and this kind of abundance of ideas as well is the idea that you can have so many ideas and you can try them all and then you whittle it back rather than starting with this very finite kind of polished thing that then is very immovable at the start. Whereas what's been a delight is coming in this early and being collaborative about it. I've gone like, whoa, explode it really big. And then the writing process is bringing it back in.
This red herring from the start is so like feels self-evident in some ways, but it's really makes such a difference in the writing process. Because as you say a body is somewhere, if you have identified really a character and a motive and almost a method from the outset for five different characters, you really pushing each of those all the way through. Like it helps.
Which
the
you can then understand so when we've talked to people like Sarah Bailey or Leanne Moriarty is the one that sticks in my head, who said, no, I don't know who did it, yeah, because she's got like seven really clear different.
That must be so difficult, yeah, to go back and insert red herrings.
Yeah, but I think she probably uses the same method, that she probably believes in the red herrings all the way along. Okay, we're going to move on to a different phase of this interview, but before we do that, I'm going to ask top three items to bring on retreat.
Mine are so dull. A table. I always bring a camping table. I now bring a monitor and a power board, like with multiple electricity sockets. I feel like most other things I can manage, but I have forgotten each of those before and have spent the entire retreat.
I did not pack a power board this time, yeah, but I have learnt that over time, yeah, the power board. But power also board. Yours sounds so sensibly, yeah, like is it orthopedic? No, that's feet.
Yeah, I know. It's really lame. I completely agree. I also thought it was going to be really cold here. So I think all I own is tracksuit pants. Like, it's quite warm.
It's very warm.
Tracksuit pants and two
t-shirts.
We had
to go for a swim this afternoon.
Like, there are certain things I could probably change in my packing technique.
Okay, your top three. Very sensible. Thank you, Catherine Collette. Anna Downs, top three.
I'm going to endorse those tracksuit pants. Not only because they're very nice, very sexy, but I would say the first one is really comfy clothes. Clothes that you feel good in, clothes that you want to work in. For me, that's like comfortable clothes, but where, like, I feel nice in them. You know, that Liz Gilbert thing of dress up for your work.
You do look very nice, I must say.
Guys, that's very sweet. I would say, yeah, your comfiest clothes, like bring some, if it's going to be cold, definitely bring your Uggies and your tracksuit pants, and, you know, just make sure you're in your most comfortable gear. Gin. You're going to need that.
Definitely. And the time at which to crack it.
Ding, ding, ding. 5 yep. o'clock, gin yep. o'clock. Everybody assemble.
Yeah.
I would say some noise cancelling headphones or earphones, but just because that's kind of my jam. That's what I love. Mm. I sometimes, in a working day, just walk around with them, you know, the noise-cancelling AirPods in my ears the whole day long.
I would not have picked you for a noise-cancelling headphone person. I would have picked you for a music person.
I do enjoy a bit of music, but I've got, you know, kind of the sort of brain that can't deal with a lot of stimulation at once. So, you know, it's that hyper-focus thing. I can really get into the groove if that's all I'm focusing on. I like to edit with a bit of nice chill music on. That kind of helps me. But I would say noise cancelling headphones. And you know, for me as well, I'll always bring whatever helps you sleep best. Oh, and sorry, this is going to five. Like something that's going to encourage you to move your body. So if that is a yoga mat, if it's, you know, just some joggers because, you know, you want to go for a walk. It might be some free weights. It might be whatever. Just something that's going to encourage you to move your body every day. That's really important for me on a writing retreat, but it's something that I think we should all, as people that sit down at desks a lot, be factoring into our day almost like a daily meal. You know, like we should all be moving our bodies at regular intervals. I think
you have done some very impressive moving of your body. I would like to shout out to Catherine and I, who did 5 minutes of freezing, basically Wim Hof method, in the Thompson River.
I think it was the entry into the river that was like the most impressive. I scooted down, saw mud and got back out. Kate bravely went in. I followed.
I
and you did the belly flop.
You did do the belly flop because perfection. Safety first. You want to make sure there's nothing underneath you. But that is my that first item is generally, although not if we go to mask, but generally bathers because I'm always so disappointed when I don't bring them because that does encourage me to get in the water. So I'm going to say bathers. The second, which I know I haven't even cracked yet, is pickled fish. It's just my thing. There's also thunder and lightning.
It's like shaking the house.
It is shaking the house. I'm not sure if that will come through on the recording, but there is thunder and lightning right now, so it's very cozy here. Pickled fish is the thing that I would not normally have at home. So some people will bring away, you know, salted caramel, chocolate, whatever. Pickled fish is mine. So we've got bathers, pickled fish, and I want to shout out to our bookshelf. Yeah, our collaborative bookshelf. Obviously, Anna flew in, so she was somewhat limited, still made some requests. Catherine went to the library and picked up some books that we required. There's also quite a fabulous collection at the Airbnb that we are in, which has served amazing purposes. So I think, and I've, you know, procrastinated by reading at least 5 books already. So I think the books are important.
But I think that's something that I haven't had on a retreat before, is a kind of communal bookshelf, which I believe is something that you guys do on the reg.
It's true.
So what we have in the corner by the fireplace is like, you know, this sort of everybody puts their books that they've brought with them in a communal library kind of thing. And several times I've gone to it and, you know, plucked something out, and while I've been having my morning coffee, I'll just like plunge into something that I wouldn't normally read, which has been really cool. And everybody's obviously reading a lot of different nonfiction and stuff, you know, around there. I mean, it's a really weird collection of material.
Very strange.
But it's brilliant. And I think I shall insist upon that at future retreats.
I love it. Love it.
This episode, the featured book is brought to you by UQP, and we are delighted to be talking to Kirsty Jagger about her debut novel, Rose Ghetto. Kirsty Jagger is a journalist by trade. In 2019, she won the inaugural Heyman Mentorship Award, established by acclaimed Australian author Catherine Heyman, for a writer from a background of social or economic disadvantage. Rose Ghetto takes some inspiration from growing up in the Housing Commission estates of Sydney's western suburbs. Welcome, Kirsty, to the First Time Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Massive congratulations on the book. It is so gripping. I felt incredibly tense reading it, but I also could not stop. We are going to talk about Rose Ghetto, but before we do, I wanted to start with you. Nowadays, you're a writer and an author. Was writing always a part of your life growing up?
I think probably less so writing, but reading. I've always loved reading, and books have been a great kind of escape for me. Kind of growing up in a similar way to Shayla, it was kind of a passport into a different kind of world for me. And from that love of writing, from that love of reading, that kind of gave me this kind of feeling as a 10-year-old that I wanted to write books because I wanted to give other children that escape. So I initially wanted to write children's books, I guess because in the mind of a child, that's kind of how it all kind of came together. Obviously, the book that I wrote, it's not a children's book, and it's, you know, it's not the book that I, as a child, anticipated writing, obviously, for many different reasons. But I think that desire to write came from my love of reading, which I think is true for many authors, really.
That is true. Yeah. Do you remember the first thing that you ever had published?
Oh, that's a very good question. I remember this horrible experience as I must have been year 4, and being given a writing task. It was like you had to write a story, and I had a lot of and then this happened and then this happened and then and I remember the teacher making me go back and take all of the and thens out and rewriting the story. Yeah. And it kind of scarred me a little bit, and when I was going through the editing process for Rose Ghetto and the editor put in and then in one section, I was like, hang on a second, what is this? Because my year 4 teacher was very firm about the fact that this could not happen. And now you, a professional editor, are telling me that maybe it can happen. And so, you know, that was an interesting moment for me. I think, you know, obviously it wasn't published, but I think that was kind of the first experience of writing a story before my love of reading really kicked in. At that point, I wasn't a strong reader. And to be honest, I couldn't really read properly until I was in year 4. I was quite behind in my reading. And it was only when I was in year 4, so it mustn't have been my year 4 teacher, I must have been in year 1 when that scary thing happened at the end then. But my year 4 teacher introduced me to The Magic Faraway Tree, and my love of reading kind of took off with that. And, you know, I went crazy with reading books and, you know, hundreds of books that I consumed from the school library, and that kind of kicked it off. But I think, you know, I when I finished university, I became a journalist. So I think, you know, my first published work was probably as a journo, not as a creative writer.
Mm. How funny.
That's a very long-winded answer, sorry.
No, it's great. Those rules that we're taught in primary school, I think weirdly stay with us, because there must be a moment in primary school where you're told not to use said, like to come up with more interesting language. And I feel like sometimes you see authors that concept has really stuck with, whereas I think like once you've learned those things as an adult writer, the advice is really just use said, like make that tag as invisible as possible.
Yeah, so throw out everything you learnt in primary school.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
The story. And yeah. Just, yeah, I think, and also you learn more. The more you read, the more you learn about those things. But it was an interesting thing for me. I didn't expect that very early childhood trauma part around, and then to come up in editing professionally a book that was going to be published. It was something that I didn't anticipate at all.
Your childhood self would have loved it though, right?
Oh no, she's vindicated 100%.
So Rose Ghetto is your debut novel. We'll start with an elevator pitch. What is it about?
So it's an Australian working class coming of age story, and it follows the trials and tribulations of a young girl named Shayla as she's growing up in poverty amongst violence. And it follows the first 18 years of her life as she's struggling to kind of break free of those systems and cycles. And there's a lot that happens within that period of time. You meet her when she's three, you leave her when she's 18. But there's quite a journey in between those ages.
Mm. When did you know that you wanted to write this story, and how did you begin?
Ooh, I feel like I've always wanted to write about Rosemeadow, which is a suburb in Sydney's southwest, it's in Western Sydney, and I grew up there. I moved around a lot, but I spent quite a few years in Rosemeadow, and I always wanted to write about it. It was a really interesting place. It's changed a lot. There's been a lot of gentrification, and the dynamics and the population has changed. But it kind of always stayed with me. I found it really interesting. There were really interesting characters and very interesting stories. And not stories that I'd come across. And I always had this idea of writing about it. This story kind of came about because I went back to Rosemeadow when I was doing a writing course. So I was doing the Faber Writing Academy with Alan and Unwin. And I was really struggling with detail. As a journalist, you write really succinctly and factually. And so getting that detail of, you know, place was really difficult for me because it's, you know, it's considered fluff and you'd cut that kind of stuff out. So I went back to Rosemeadow to get some photos and videos and kind of, you know, get my memory jogging. And the street where I grew up was gone, completely demolished.
Wow.
And I just had that moment of going, oh shit, I'm too late. And now the thing I've come back to try and capture so I can transcribe it and put it on a page is gone, and what do I do with that? And so there was this moment of loss in that, but there was also a moment of feeling like, good, it's gone, because I wasn't happy there, and I don't think a lot of people are happy there. So it was a very bittersweet moment for me of being glad it had been erased, but I felt like it had been erased maybe a little bit too soon for my purposes at that point. But when I got in the car and I drove home, you kind of stare into the middle distance and you're having that thought process that happens. I was like, this is the beginning of the story and the end. This coming back to a place, finding it gone, and then telling the story of how the character came to be there and how they came to leave it and what happened to them after that, and kind of like just a life journey, but so incredibly marked by a particular place.
Word I used before was intense or gripping. The place is really, the book feels very anchored in place, and the place is a bit of a scary place at times. There are lots and lots of tough moments in this story, and you really wish you could step into the world and save Shayla, but obviously that's not possible. But alongside that, as you say in the preface, there's hope and love and light among the darkness. Were those elements always a part of the story?
I think so, but I think it also gets to a point with the writing, maybe on the third or fourth draft, where the characters take on a life of their own and you feel like you're just transcribing what they would do or say. And so they kind of take you on a journey themselves. And so the stories for me always kind of come with, I kind of get the beginning and the end. And once I've got that, I know I've got to kind of piece together the rest in the middle. And that first draft is kind of like a skeleton of like plot points and kind of broad overarching things and giving me that general direction. But by the time you're getting into that third and fourth draft and the characters have, they really have character. And they're very much coming into themselves. I think Shayla's character is so hopeful. Even in the moments where there is darkness, I think she's just, she never, despite all of the horrible things that happen, she doesn't dwell in that, which I think is really powerful. And I think because of that, because she's always striving and moving forward, and but she's still learning and she's still capturing all of these lessons, there is this hope that she will overcome it, and she does. And I wanted the reader, that's why I wanted to start the book at the end of the story.
Yeah.
Because I wanted the reader to know that Shayla was going to be okay, because you have to hold Shayla's hand through some pretty tough times.
Mm.
And you want to know at the end she's going to be okay. And I wanted the reader to know, I wanted to have that contract with the reader to know that she was going to be okay at the end. So that was really important to me, to have that hopeful moment kind of captured at the beginning so you can stick it out with her through those tough times.
That's actually a really good point. I noticed that in like a subconscious way, but I didn't consciously realize that. That's very true. You do know that she turns out like that, that she sort of rises above, or I'm not sure what the word is, but she comes out good in the end, despite many of the things that happened to her. There's also these lovely small moments in the book, like when she moves to Rose Meadow, the you know, I think she puts the bins out and there are a couple of kids that she connects with, like these lovely little moments that really mean a lot, I think, within the context of the story.
Yeah, and I think so those kids that she meets are Charlie and Sean, and they end up being, you know, really important in her life. And it's interesting because people, when they've interviewed me, have, because the book is dedicated to the gutter kids, people assume the gutter kids are Charlie and Sean, but actually they're completely fictitious characters that I created because they didn't want Shayla to be alone. And but also from a writing kind of point of view, I didn't want to do internal monologues. So I needed somebody that Shayla could talk to. And she has a lot of, there's a lot of big ideas about God and about fate and about where you are in the world. And what about if you don't like where you are in the world? And but what about if it's part of a bigger plan? These, you know, if that was happening in an internal monologue, I feel like the vibe around Shayla would be a little bit different. I wanted her to have kids around her age who were going through similar things that she could bounce those ideas off verbally. So that was quite a strategic decision in terms of that. But it's been interesting because I think the Charlie and Sean feel so real and authentic that people really connected to them, and they're like, oh, it was there a Charlie and was there a Sean? No, there wasn't. I was such a loner. But I've been very introverted, and I've only just learned to be an extrovert for my work over the past decade. But, you know, I think it's been really lovely to see how much people love those kids. And really connect with them. And that was also a decision, because I feel like if you'd come to Shayla as an adult, if she and people have come at Lauren with this perspective as well, there's a bit more judgment when you're dealing with an adult.
Yeah.
Whereas when you've got a child as your main character, you realize that they don't have much, if any, control over the things that are happening around them. And they're just doing what they can in the small ways that they can to live.
I think as well the Charlie and Sean and Shayla, sometimes the things that they don't say to each other that they innately understand of each other is extremely telling as well.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful relationship, and I had a lot of help with my editor as well, bringing the dialogue, like really tightening that up, and just looking at that, you know, from draft to the published, like the finished version. Oh, it's just such a magical thing to see it just like really be honed. Like,
yeah,
I can't even describe it, but it's been, I've really enjoyed the editing process. Actually, I learned so much through it that it's been really incredible.
Yeah, I reckon editing is the fun bit too. Shayla, our main character, perhaps echoes of yourself here, finds a lot of solace in books. What do the books that she has that she owns mean to her, and what does this kind of world offer?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think Shayla's character is a lot smarter than me. And like I said, so you meet Shayla and she's got like a book in her hands basically as soon as she's out of the womb. That wasn't my experience. And I kind of came a little bit later to the reading part. But I think what I wanted the books that she's reading in Rose Ghetto to convey, you know, there's a sense of time and place. So I wanted some of that. But and that also comes through music and, you know, street names and things like that. I wanted a very strong sense of time and place. But what I wanted to do with the books is show kind of this change in her perception of the world. So there's a very important conversation she has with Sean about magic and whether or not it exists. And she's been reading these, you know, Harry Potter-esque books and escaping her situation through these books. And he kind of looks at her and says, you know, this is all imaginary and you need to face up to the reality of the world in children's language. Mm. And after that, the books change. And she's reading things like Lord of the Flies, or she's reading, you know, Animal Farm, or whatever it is that she's kind of reading. It gets more grown up, a little bit darker, probably more realistic to what she's experiencing around her. And so there's this, I wanted the books to show that that change, that growth, that painful growth. But so she's used books to kind of escape, and then she uses them to learn how to navigate her world and her place in that world. And I think that's a really important part of the book for me.
Yeah, I love that. Once you had the initial seed of the idea for this book, what did the actual writing process look like?
Oh, it was a mess. I wish that I could say it was like amazing. There was a lot of joy in it, but probably not in the first little bit. I think, you know, so when I went to FABE, I wrote, you know, you put in 10,000 words and none of those 10,000 words exist anymore. My writing, you know, was good enough to get in, but like the story changed a lot when I was there. Part of that was because, you know, amazing teachers and also classmates and, you know, suddenly I had a network of people that I could share my writing with, where, you know, writing before had been quite insular. So that investment in my writing changed everything. And then from kind of learning, because I feel like I had to unlearn some of my journalistic trade to write a book. So that educational piece was really important to me. And then mentoring, obviously, as well, with Catherine Heyman, who's an incredible human being and an amazing writer and a fabulous teacher, like all of the things. She's just a perfect human being, really. That mentorship took everything to the next level, you know, when you're trying to like figure out plot points and like what's the symbolism of this, and you know, all of these things that you don't necessarily think about when you're first starting to write. All of that kind of detail coming out, and then also more investment in learning about writing. So, you know, I read a lot of craft books, I did a lot of writing New South Wales courses, I zoom into different online things. I was really conscious that I had to learn a new craft. And so there was a lot of that went on throughout the entire process of the writing of the book, which took 5 years. It took 4 years writing and 1 year of editing. So, you know, it was quite a long journey, but I was committed to this kind of continuous education and learning through that process, which was really helpful. But in terms of, you know, what it looks like at 3 a.m. when you're trying to finish, there were lots of... you know those little index cards that you used to write speeches on at school?
Yes, yep.
Lots of those just scattered all over the floor, like me moving plot points around, which is something that I'd learned as part of one of my courses. And it was very helpful to have So I mean, there was a little bit more flexible and you could move it around physically and see how it kind of fit and how it connected. I did a lot of my writing during lockdown. So, you know, the famous thumb glue, thumb on seat, fingers on keypad, you just got to go for it. And there was a lot of copy. There was a lot of no-dos.
No-dos.
It was probably not the healthiest process. I don't have a particularly healthy process for anything in my life, so I wouldn't necessarily recommend caffeinating yourself into oblivion, but it worked for me. So, you know, you do what you need to. But it was, look, it was a really interesting process.
Whatever works, really.
I was very tired at the end of it.
You mentioned Catherine Hayman. Your book actually won the Hayman Mentorship Award. Was that award something you had worked towards? Can you tell me how you found out that you had won?
Yeah, so look, so I'd come across Catherine Hayman when I was doing my writing course, and she has a newsletter. She has these amazing conversations on creations that she does with authors. And so it was another resource that I tapped into when I was, you know, investing in my writing education. And she and I follow on her social medias as well. So at one point there was an announcement that there would be this award. I thought, you know what? I come from a background of social and economic disadvantage. I'm going to give it a whirl and see what happens, you know. And I entered it. It won. And I remember getting the email about it. And just, I was like, no, this isn't real. But, you know, like it actually, I think what it really meant for me was it gave me the confidence to keep writing. Mm-hmm. It said to me, what you've got is good. It needs to be worked on, but it's worthy of this. And this person believes in the potential. And she did. She believed in, like, you know, when I had a lot of self-doubt about, you know, why am I doing this and what am I trying to say here? She just provided this clarity. And having won that award said to me that this isn't just a pipe dream. You've got something here, but you need to work on it. You know, so that was, I think it just gave me that little uptick of confidence that I needed to keep going, you know, because like I at a certain point I went down to part-time work to, you know, write my book, and people are like, why are you going down to part-time? I'm like, oh, I'm writing a book. And just
it's such a hard thing to say, isn't it, to put into the world, because it's such a chance to take, you know?
Yeah, it's a chance, but also, you know, like people, you know, it's so hard to get published. And so you just have that moment of going, people are like, oh, okay, isn't it a smart idea? And you're like, and I got to the point where I was like, you know what, I've only got one shot at this, and this is something I've wanted for as long as I can remember. So I'm going to give it a red hot go.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a luxury in being able to do that. And you know, it took a while to get there, but I think you have to invest in your writing, and you have to give it the time it needs as well, if you can. And that, you know, I think that's people, particularly women, I think struggle finding that time because we're juggling so many things. And, you know, I'm not a mum and I'm not, you know, doing a million amazing things, and I still struggle.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine people who have to like juggle families and all of these things and work and, you know, in COVID, home learning, oh my goodness, like, you know, I just can't imagine. So, you know, I was really lucky that I had that gift of time, also really understanding manager whose husband works in publishing. So she was like, oh yeah, no, I get this. You need that time. You go take that time. And she was really supportive. So, you know, I think I was very lucky on that front to have a network of mostly believers. And then, you know, you get a few doubters and you're like, well, maybe it does seem insane, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Well, it paid off. It is an excellent book and it is in the world. It came out in July this year. What do you hope that readers take away from it?
I would like to think that readers who have been struggling with similar situations to what Shayla finds herself in or her mum Lauren come away from it feeling less alone.
Mm.
I think for me it was really important to me that people felt seen.
Mm.
And that stories that we normally don't hear get told.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the reason this is so important, particularly for an area like Rosemeadow, is we don't normally hear about Rosemeadow unless something goes wrong, like the Rosemeadow riot in 2009. And then there's this particular media lens that gets cast over an entire suburb and a community. And that's not necessarily representative of everyone in that community, but also doesn't accurately reflect all of the things that have gone into that community that have made it And it was a dysfunctional community. There are so many issues within that community at that time, and they were glossed over. And I wanted to be able to kind of shine a spotlight on that. So, for the Chandler Trent's a really lonely path. I think every single human being on earth can relate to sitting alone with some of that dark shit some of the time. And I hope when they read this story and they hear Shayla's voice and they hold her hand through this, they feel less alone having met her. That's my hope. And also, I think a kinder lens through which to view people and places that we are often quick to judge. And it was why I strategically chose to write from a child's perspective as well, because we're less likely. I think we judge adults for having more control over their situations, but actually sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
And I think we are really quick to judge that. But, if Shayla's love of books hadn't been there, if she hadn't been educated, would she have been able to break out of that cycle that she was in? It would have been more difficult. There are so many things that keep people stuck. And we need to be kind when we approach people because we don't know their stories, and we never will.
Kirsty, we have a lot of listeners to this show that are writers. What is the best advice you have in relation to writing?
I think you need to invest in your writing. And I say that as someone who hasn't always had a lot of money. So I want to contextualize that a little bit, because I think there is some privilege in being able to invest in your writing financially. And so things like Faber Writing Academy is amazing. I had to save up a long time to do that. But it was incredible, and it changed the trajectory of my writing career. But also there are so many like podcasts like this where you can get information from writers, and we want to share this. We want to hear all of these amazing voices. So and it's something that we're all passionate about. So find podcasts, borrow craft books from your local library, join a writing group, log into free webinars. There's so many different things, look at the Australian Society for Authors, look at Writing New South Wales. They have things on their website. You don't always have to pay a membership to do those things. There'll be information that you can get and read. Read all of the books. You'll never read all of the books, but as many books as you possibly can manage. But I think, and look at your reading as learning about your craft. And I think all of the things in this is just about learning. And that investment doesn't have to be financial. It can be time. Give yourself time.
That is great advice. On the topic of reading, can you recommend a book by a debut author? It can be from any place, any year, any genre.
So I recently, so this book I've loved for a long, long time, and I've read it many times, and I'm sure many of your listeners have read it as well, but Song of the Crocodile by Nadi Simpson is just
fabulous.
It's heartbreaking and powerful and so important. And I think if you've read it before, read it again. I think it's really important, particularly right now. And if you haven't read it, you are missing out, and you absolutely need to read it. It's incredible. And I had the absolute joy of listening to Nadi at the Blue Mountains Writers Festival recently. And she's just an incredible human being. And I just had that moment at Blue Mountains Writers Festival. I was like, if I could aspire to be any person, her calm, kindness and consideration are just amazing to me. I'm in awe of her as a person. I'm just speechless. So that book, that Song of the Crocodile, I love it.
That is a wonderful note to end on. Thank you, Kirsty Jagger, for being on the First Time Podcast.
Thank you so much.
Now we are going to do some recommendations. And because it's the three of us, Anna, we're going to go to you first. I think you're going to have something exciting that we wouldn't have thought of.
So I've got a book, an audio book, and a podcast, if that's all right.
The trifecta.
So my book recommendation is Emma Klein's The Guest. I've never read Emma Klein before. I've obviously heard a lot about her. And about the girls. This for me was like one of those, I just could not put it down. And it's not because it's, its intensity does not come from, you know, the action. It's not really a kind of, and then we learn that kind of book. And actually, you know, before when I said, oh, you know, if you're writing a crime suspense thriller, you know, you're going to want to hang it on that kind of framework. Emma Klein proves that you actually don't, and that I'm completely wrong, because it's atmosphere and the tension is, it comes from this sense of you are on a rattling train heading towards a cliff, but you don't know how far away the cliff is. You don't know how the train's going to go over.
This isn't a metaphor for her writing. This is actually what it's about.
No.
Okay, right. Sorry.
It's not about a train. So what it is about is a young woman who is a... Bags, mine. I'm having it. I think that tale has been told. No, so Emma Klein's The Guest is about a young woman who it's not explicitly stated, but it's very, very implicit. She's a sex worker. She's an escort, I think. And she has been brought to Long Island. It's like the Hamptons kind of place, with a rich client. And she's been invited to spend the summer there. So she's in this glorious house, and she's also running from something, from a kind of a shadowy threat that becomes more specific as the story goes along. She's done something, and there is somebody chasing her. So she's very happy to be in this kind of glorious place. But what happens fairly quickly into the book is she makes a mistake. It's kind of like a thing that exposes her as being not of that world. And she is asked to leave. But instead of going back to the city where this kind of threat is, she stays. And it's then 7 days of her trying to survive. You know, she's just a grifter, trying to adapt and survive in an environment that's not her own. And that's kind of all
that
I want.
Incredible.
Well, it really is, because it is so tense and I could not put it down. It's beautifully written, but it just has this kind of atmosphere where you're so uneasy the whole time. And yet, you know, the environment is very rich and it's very beautiful. It's pools and kind of, you know, beautiful private mansions and cars and clubs, like country clubs. You know, it's kind of like it should be gorgeous, but it's just horrible. Like the whole time you're kind of going, oh my God, something terrible is going to happen. My audiobook recommendation is Smoke Gets in Your Eyes by Caitlin Doughty. It's an American nonfiction book about a woman who spent many years working as a mortician.
Is this a new book? Or is this
I don't
around?
Believe
no.
it is. I think it's
like
been
I
around
know
for a
when
long
this
time.
Came out.
The first time it was recommended to me was by a very lovely publicist at Text, actually, weirdly. I think back in 2020? It's about everything to do with death, like fear of death, fear of mortality, and a woman kind of coming to different conclusions about how we look at and deal with death in our kind of daily lives on a macro and micro level. Very, very funny. Very, very good. Really recommend that. Mm-hmm. And podcast, I'm going to be really useless. It's called Ghost Story. So just... I can't remember who did it.
We will link in our show notes.
Yeah, find it and link it. It's basically a British journalist. I think he's some foreign correspondent, but he is married into the Dancy family. So if you know Hugh Dancy, the actor, maybe it's his kind of family. And there is a kind of extraordinary thing that happened to this journalist when he was a little boy. You know, there was some weird paranormal goings on in his childhood bedroom that he kind of forgot about as an adult, until somebody rings up an old neighbor and says, I think there are other families that have lived in that house that have experienced the same thing. And that, investigating that, kind of finding these families and going, did you experience XYZ? They discover this bananas link with his wife's family. And it just goes on from there. Like, he's just investigating it deeper and deeper, and it's like this crazy rabbit hole. It beggars belief, but it's really addictive, really fun. Ghost Story.
Oh, I love it. Kate, have you got recommendations?
I do. I have a watching recommendation. I had a little time out. Some people might have seen from my socials last week or the week before because I was exhausted and had a small dramatic collapse. And so I spent some time in bed and I watched, I binge watched a Netflix series called Bodies. Catherine Collette, you went on a podcast this week. Can you just tell us about it and link to it so we can link to
it? I went on a podcast called Is This Real Life with Mandy Slutska. I have linked on Instagram. We talked for like an hour and a half on Real Housewives related stuff.
Are you leaving me for someone who can talk to you about Real Housewives?
It was pretty fun. It was good. Quite a big article had come out in Vanity Fair the week before. So we were discussing that, but we had quite different perspectives, which is a bit of an odd way to start a conversation on a note of disagreement. But I have linked to that on my Instagram. In terms of reading, I just have an article that is mildly depressing. Would you like to hear about it?
Not really.
I'll give you the headline bits. Kylie Ladd posted this on X. I have trouble saying X. It still feels like it should be called Twitter. It's called The 10 Awful Truths About Book Publishing. Should I read on? The first awful truth, the number of books being published each year has exploded. So it basically has 10 truths. Some of them feel a bit self-evident. This one probably comes as no surprise to anyone. It's a US-based article. Some of the statistics are hard to get on numbers of books that are published because they include self-published titles. But according to this, they say between 500,000 and 1,000,000 new titles were published by traditional publishers in the US alone last year.
Whoa.
They say yes. And I think there's like, so say if there's 200 million people in the US, 100 million, a million, anyway, I can't add the numbers on the fly. It's a lot of books. This is a quote. And here is the truly shocking figure. The annual number of new titles published each year has grown more than 10 times in the past 16 years. And then you cross-reference that with fact number, where are we? Fact number three, the book marketplace, so the number of books that people are buying, has grown hardly at all in the past 20 years, despite the explosion of books.
Kylie, why
published.
Did you post this?
I
why
know.
Why did you share this?
So I don't know. I mean, some of the statistics and facts that they include are really interesting, obviously US-based, as I said. But
anything uplifting? Anything to draw?
A lot of stuff that we talk about a bit. Average book sales are shockingly small. I think they say average 300 print copies. What I found super interesting was their book scan. So what their version of Nielsen book scan, just called book scan. Found that 6.7% of titles sell more than 10,000 copies.
So 6.7. That's
this
it.
This is in the US. So people have
what
talked here.
Doing?
People have talked here about that $10,000 copy figure being a bestseller in Australia. But you're looking at US, which is a market that is at least 10 times larger. Only not even 7% are achieving that 10,000 copy figure. So it's quite sobering. They do make the comment, one of their facts number seven, is that most books today are selling only to the authors and publishers communities. Yeah, so some of they do come up with some strategies at the end that aren't hugely fleshed out.
Okay, go. Give us a strategy. Finish on a high, Catherine. Let's give our listeners something to go home with.
Said, events, immersion, events and immersion experiences replace traditional publicity in moving the needle. Leverage the authors and publishers' communities. Well, it seems a bit self-evident, that one. It did say something about, this was one of the awful truths, most book marketing today is done by authors, not by publishers. So I think that's really interesting against the backdrop of some of the discussion we've been having about book tours and investment in book tours and who organises those. The massive point is this idea of like 10 times the number of books have been published in the past 10 years, yet the buyership of books has not changed. That is like a troubling anomaly.
Well, to segue delightfully using both the author's own network and the idea of events, let's talk about what we've got coming up. shall we?
Yes, that sounds fun. So I have, I am hosting the Nick Cave Anthology launch. That event is coming up on Thursday, the 16th of November. It is at Readings in St Kilda. Very excited about that. That will be an event, I think, that will have a lot of great authors at it. This book looks, I haven't read it yet because they're still sending it out, but it has some pretty incredible contributors from Kate Kennedy, Brad
Tony
Presser,
Birch,
Mark Smith. Like, it'll be a really good one, and they do generally go along to launches of things, so good one to turn up to.
I will not be crossing the river for that event on
brutal.
That night. I am so sorry, Catherine, because I have another event. So if people cannot cross the river and they want to come to hear me at Wheeler's Hill, you can come and chat to me there. I'll be doing a free author talk. But I am going to go and see the people, some of the authors from the Nick Cave at Eltham Bookshop on the 6th of December. So I'll put a link in our show notes to that as well. I think Tony Birch and Tony Jordan and Mark Smith are all going to, and Bram are all going to be there doing readings. Catherine and I are going to be in conversation down the beach. On the 17th of November, you can catch us at Aries Inlet at the amazing Great Escape Books. Anna.
Next week, I am recording an audiobook.
Woo! I wanted to ask you about that. I actually had some questions. We know that you have a background in acting.
Yeah.
How do you get into, because I think all of us that have kids and have read kids' books start to fancy ourselves as pretty good at it. How did you actually get into it?
Well, I read my, you know, I'm legitimately an actor.
You're not just sitting at home.
I trained at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London, and I worked professionally as an actor as well. So even though it sometimes feels like I'm kind of masquerading, I have to remind myself that I am actually.
Who does it feel like you're masquerading? Definitely doesn't feel like.
Well,
that
because I left acting and became an author instead, and sometimes in particular, I don't know if it's depends on the company I'm in or what, but I sometimes find it really hard to say I am an actor. I say I'm a former actor. But then. In recent years, I've started to go, well, do you ever stop being the thing that you trained to do or loved doing? And does calling yourself a former anything, what does that do? Like, does it serve you? Does it close doors? I don't know. So I've started saying, well, I am an actor, actually. I haven't worked in a long time, but that's what these audio narration gigs give me is you know that I'm being hired. They're not my books anymore. I'm being hired as a voice artist, as a narrator, which is deeply satisfying and a kind of a wonderful, it feels very cyclical, or I don't know, it just feels good, it feels appropriate. So when I wrote The Safe Place, there was just a kind of general feeling amongst the team that I would. It was like just an assumption that I would narrate them. And I said, oh, God, no. Don't you want me to audition? Don't be ridiculous. Don't you want an actual professional to do it? And they were like, well why? Like, why wouldn't it be you? I did it and I loved it. And then when the Shadow House rolled around, I had, I didn't design it this way, but the protagonist was from England. And so I read her parts and we got a professional actress to read the other part. And then this lovely thing happened. The gorgeous Anna Snookster got in touch with me and asked if I would read an early copy of her wonderful novel, Out of Breath, which I duly did and was very honoured to do so. And I loved it. But one of the big things that I thought as I was reading it was I have to narrate this. And it was a real thing of like, I'm the only person that can do this. Like, I hope that doesn't sound kind of conceited, but it was, I felt very connected to the material, but the protagonist is from where I'm from. It was about a woman from Britain, from England, from the north of England, traveling to Australia and backpacking and work, you know, doing some seasonal jobs. And I was like, I know that feeling. I felt very emotionally connected to it.
Can you talk about does it feel like there's an acting element to it? Like, do do you really think about the what voice this person would have?
Yes. And I do a lot of prep work for it as well, because I take it very really seriously. Yeah. That's a really big honor and a big responsibility. If somebody's saying, I entrust you with the performance of my book, you know, but at the same time, you have to also, as the narrator, be really aware that this is not your time to shine. This is not your performance. You are the conduit of the story. So there has to be a little bit of kind of paring back, I think, of a performance that you might deliver, say, on a stage or something, because you're not embodying necessarily those stories. You're letting the story flow through you and into the ears of a listener. So that's been really interesting to me to kind of grapple with that and try and make that.
That's a real balance, isn't it?
Yeah. Really, really fun, though. I can't think of a better way to spend one's time, let alone get paid for it, than to sit and read a story aloud. Anyway, Anna's book is so brilliant, and I really, really loved it. And so I sent my endorsement to her with a little PS saying, I don't know how you feel about this, because you might, like, I didn't know if she would want another author's name attached to her work and if that might be a conflict of interest or what. But I was like, I don't know how you feel about this, but I would really love to audition. And she said, funnily enough, Belinda just asked me who would be my ideal narrator, and I said you.
How nice is that?
It was really, really nice. Oh. And it just felt very much like a kind of, it just felt
what
beautiful.
What a perfect pairing.
Yeah. But it felt like something that, it was something that we both wanted. And it felt like a really lovely, it felt like a lovely gift.
So is this the book that you're doing next week?
Is it? No. So the book that I'm doing next week, I'm not allowed to say who it is, because the author has not yet announced it. So I can't talk about what it is, but it's really good. It's a debut. I'm really, really looking forward to it. And again, it was one of those things where I was asked to read an early copy. I was delighted to, and I just connected with the material on a kind of an emotional level. And again, the protagonist, it's a voice, it's a Northern English voice. And I just said, I don't know how you feel about it, but would you mind, like, how would you feel about me auditioning? And it was just like a resounding yes, please, which is so lovely. So I think it's a big responsibility. I take it very, very seriously. I know that it is not my work or my spotlight. It's just a real honor to be able to help someone else's beautiful story reach new readers or listeners.
Can you just talk us through the actual logistics? So it takes the full week.
Yeah, so usually you're booked for 5 days. They try really hard not to have you recording for more than 4 hours at a time. So usually that's, two and a half, maybe even three, in my experience, hours of reading. And then you'll take a break. And then often kind of after the break, you're all over the place. So, you know, they'll... When you're on a roll, you'll be reading and it'll, you know, you'll do like 2-3 pages without dropping a syllable, without stumbling at all. But when it's going badly and your brain's really tired, it'll be line. Mm. Oh God, messed that up. Take me back. Line. Next line. Oh God, stumbled, messed it up. Like it can be quite frustrating. But I've never had to do more than 5 days. But I guess it depends. It depends on the length of the book, obviously, and the engineer as well. It kind of depends on what studio you're with and who you're working with too.
Minor question: do you read from an actual book?
Read from an iPad.
iPad, so yeah. No page turning.
So it's just a kind of swipe, scroll kind of thing, which is brilliant. And you're on your own in a booth, and your engineer is on their own on the other side. Oh my goodness, that was a really loud thunderclap. I don't know if anyone's... Oh. It's really stormy here, very, very loud.
It's the shake. You could feel the whole house.
Yeah, so you're alone in a kind of one half of the studio, and they're on the other side with the mixing desk. And... you've both got headphones on, so it's quite intimate. And I have to say, there was a really funny kind of experience with Anna Snookstra's book, because she has a sex scene, and it's a really good sex scene.
It's great
sex scene. I was working at a studio in North Sydney, and I had my headphones on and the engineer had his on, and there is that kind of slight intimacy in terms of what's in your ears, and I, you know, I kind of had to say, okay, this is going to get awkward. It's going to be, you know, hold on to your hats, guys. And then you go into the sex scene and it's just you and the engineer. It's very intimate. It can be really, really fun. It's brilliant. And it's always nice when the engineer kind of directs you as well, gives you a bit of guidance. That's nice.
I think that's the note to end on. Kate?
She does do such good voices.
I know.
She's done really good voices in all of her stories.
Good reason to set a book in the north of England.
Yeah,
north of
do England. It
Is
right
that right?
Now.
So we can get Anna to read it for us.
I'm open to anything. Yes. I'll do anything.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.